Thank you, David. Well, it's a great privilege here to be here, and I owe a lot to this man over here to even know anything about string theory. And I actually, when I decided to do a project I'll talk about later, I went to a far-off deserted island in the Caribbean and read about string theory, which was a good place to do it. We're going to have a little bit of fun today. No surprise, I'm not going to use any chalk on the chalkboard. This is as close as I will get to that. We're going to look at a lot of pictures, and hopefully at the end, if we have a little time, we might even listen to some sound to go along with it. So first, a little brief history of time and why I'm not a physicist. This covers a span of some period of time, and each of these covers have had some meaning or some impact on me, and I'm sure many others in this room. And it really kind of describes historically what it is that, let me get my mouse here, why I'm not a physicist. Probably like many of you, and this was actually inspired by a comment that David made the other night at a public forum or a public speaker, and he talked about being 13 years old and wanting to be a theoretical physicist when he was knowing that he wanted to be a physicist when he was 13 years old. I was about four here. And believe it or not, my mother was a lifelong artist, and she was also a scrapbooker, and she kept absolutely everything, which I've since found. This was the actual box for the clothes that I had on. I still have, and I remember it. Those of you in the back probably can't read this too closely, but it says, Smaby Allen Rocket Research. I was 70 pounds and 4'7" at the time. My eyes are still brown and my hair is still blonde. Not quite, a little gray. But, and this is an actual headline here. Now that I've read it in retrospect, baffles family is not something most kids are proud of. and I was rather ambitious as a kid, as you can see. I was going to start my own space program. Well, I suspect others in this room maybe had some childhood obsessions that related to science that have taken you to where you are. And in my case, it also happened. So I don't know how many, I don't know if this even got off the U.S., but a little known film called October Sky, and it was about a young boy who experiments with rockets, and he, I think, lived in Pennsylvania, and he ended up, you know, going to Redstone Arsenal and meeting his hero and won science fairs. That's what I did. And so coming from that young boy, I started building rockets when I was about third grade, I think. And eventually ended up, just by luck, ending up on a couple of national TV shows that are no longer around, one called To Tell the Truth, that the older people in this room might remember, and there was a show called Science All-Stars that was sponsored by Honeywell. And so it was rather a charmed childhood, and one that was completely, for me, immersed in science. It got to the point where people did not know my name, but they did call me Rocket Boy. And that really carried on until really after I was probably 15 or 16. Kind of a strange name to carry around with you. So eventually, you know, why I'm not a physicist, boy meets girl. And I didn't, even though I checked out MIT and Caltech and Rice and many other such places, I decided that because of the times that we were in, and I'll get to that, that I wanted to take a completely different path. And so when I went to college, I decided I was not going to do any science, any math, other than required, and was going to vector off into another path. How many of you have heard of Garrison Keillor and Prairie Home Companion? Probably those of you in the U.S. There's this town that doesn't exist, or lake that doesn't exist, called Lake Wobegon. But in fact, in the fantasy, it is supposed to be right down the road from St. Olaf, Minnesota. There is no such thing as St. Olaf, Minnesota, but there is a St. Olaf College, so we've always been associated with it. And all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are, of course, above average. So again, why am I not a physicist? So I ended up meeting a couple of my childhood heroes and as a child. And David made a comment earlier about Einstein, and he said that when he was growing up, Einstein was like a god, if I'm quoting you properly. And that as he matured, as David matured, he began to look at him as a man and a colleague, with all the things that go along with being a man and a colleague. I was still 5'2" and 92 pounds when I met Wernher von Braun and Edward Teller, and didn't really know much about the world at that point in time, but I knew about these people. They had been on the cover of magazines that were laying around the house, and I had tried to read books that were about them, and I had certain fantasies in my head about what it was like to be a rocket scientist. And then, there was a little change in sentiment that occurred. It turns out that, I don't know how many of you have seen this movie, but Stanley Kubrick movie, and Wernher von Braun and Edward Teller are reputedly the models for the aggregate character that became Dr. Strangelove. So, the other reason was this reason. It was a very exciting time to grow up when we were, landing on the moon. But there were some realities that occurred, which we're experiencing again at this point in time with the end of the shuttle program. And this was heard quite often around, people who were thinking about getting involved in careers in physics at that point in time. And I was one of them that received that bit of advice. And so the boy meets girl part plus this really set my path. So was it sage advice? I put this gentleman up here because he happened to be a classmate of mine in high school. So he graduated the same time I did, was a friend of mine. He wasn't, very well established. He was in the stage crew, and he was in the class play and wrestling team, but that was really all that kind of distinguished him. But he went on to become a test pilot. As you can see, flew 36 different aircraft, 7,000 hours, and he was on 4 shuttle missions, and now is head of the John F. Kennedy Space Center, and was just a couple weeks ago reminiscing with John Glenn. In fact, I think he was quoted as saying, "You're an inspiration to me because you flew at age 78, I think it was. He said, maybe I have a chance to go back up again. But again, an example of, you get advice when you were a kid, and sometimes it's bad advice. Here's another one. So this gentleman here that I met with when I was at Redstone Arsenal, in addition to meeting with Wernher von Braun, was Dr. William McCorkle. And I just tracked McCorkle back in preparing for this talk and discovered some interesting things about him. He just retired in 2009 after 52 years as a rocket scientist, a really good one. And these are his own words describing as, what he did. And I think those of you in the room will appreciate the last line, that he says that more than anything else, he had fun as a physicist. So, again, that great advice I got about what was going to happen over the next period of time, these two individuals are good examples of kind of breaking with that tradition. Well, in the end, I took a different path and as many of us did at that point in time. That actually is very close to the backpack, and that is the camera that I carried with me. And these are the two books that I had in my backpack. And the ABC of Relativity obviously was the book I read before I read Idiot's Guide to String Theory. But I was obviously interested at that point in time. The Boy Meets Girl, we ended up traveling together for a year. I don't know if you saw these little flips through here, but we visited 6 different universities in the course of that study, and that tied in with my East Asian studies and art. I did use my camera quite often. I actually studied with this gentleman as part of my study program. I found out afterwards that he was the guru to the King of Nepal and to the American ambassador to India at the time. We were in Allahabad, at Allahabad University, and it was actually a study that I was doing on East Asia. But I returned from that trip and again decided, well, maybe it's time to think about artwork. I had taken all these pictures. I actually had a grant from 3M Company, a local company, Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing in Minnesota. We had, as I recall, 4,000 slides and 300 feet of movie film to use over the course of the trip. It turned out they didn't make very good film and their processing wasn't all that great, so a lot of the images didn't turn out. I would have been better off with Kodak, but I did get back and I was fascinated by a new technology that had just come out of 3M. And this woman, who is now an esteemed artist from Chicago, was one of the first to really put science and art together. She was, as you can see, had a very interesting approach to her artwork. Sometimes she would collaborate with designers, and other times, I like this quote, that she would ask the machine, basically, what can you tell me about yourself? Kind of an interesting approach to technology. But these are images that she made with a very complicated machine, a color copier, that was introduced. And I was sufficiently enamored with it that I applied for a grant from the State Arts Council and wanted to use the machine, and she had been an artist in residence at 3M, and I thought, I want to do that. So I applied and lost. And as a result of that, I thought, well, I had kind of an entrepreneurial spirit, and so I decided, well, maybe I could start a company and I could sell these color copies to corporations. And in the course of that, I could work at night and do my art at night on this machine. And at the time, it was a very expensive machine. I mean, today it would have been $250,000, and it probably, you know, there were maybe were 10 of them in the world. But, you know, the people who designed it were right across town. So I convinced the banker to loan me some money to buy a machine, to start a company, and provide service to these corporations. So to pay the bills, I decided I better get my camera working again, and so I happened to get involved in not astronomy, actually, shooting stars, but I had a career as a rock concert photographer, which barely paid the bills, but it did allow me to buy cameras and do things that, you know, buy additional lenses. And in the course of that time, I didn't know it at the time, but I was photographing almost all these individuals are now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But at that period of time, some of them were not particularly well known. Well, then from there, this is where the science and physics and chemistry come back into it. Art meets science meets business. So this is the machine that I bought and the color copies that it created. And I had an idea based on some of the things that Sonia Sheridan had done that you could actually transfer a photographic image not only onto paper but onto fabric. And she had done that. And So I called the University of Minnesota across town, and I found this very young individual who's now in the National Academy, but at the time he was an expert in something I don't understand, multiphase polymer microstructures via process flows and chemical reaction. Well, you might ask, why would I want to talk to this person? Well, we together collaborated to figure out a way to put chemical inside of a t-shirt so that this four-color image would transfer to it and stay in it after you washed it. And we struggled, finally came up with something that worked. And this particular story, I was photographing Paul McCartney. And he had just appeared on the cover that day, as I recall. I took a picture of the Time magazine cover, transferred it onto my t-shirt, and so when I went into photograph the concert, I was in front of the stage beforehand, getting my cameras all ready, and all of a sudden, his manager walks over and said, "Where'd you get that t-shirt?" And I said, "Well, I made it." He said, "Well, that just came out today." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Come here." So I climb over, go back into the dressing room, and he goes, "Paulie, come here, you gotta see this." So McCartney walks over, looks at my t-shirt, and he says, "You want to trade?" I said, "Sure." So he has a little black French cut t-shirt that really didn't look good on me. And of course I was young and proud, and even though there were other photographers around, I wouldn't have the guts to say, "Yeah, would you mind taking a picture of me and McCartney?" But at any rate, it's a great story to tell. And shortly thereafter, I got a call from McCartney's people, and they wanted me to ship additional copies of this to them for their LA concert. Well, skipping forward, I created a company that did individual photographs on shirts. We were the first company to manufacture that kind of a product. We had 500 outlets around the country servicing, and you see them now today with pillows and t-shirts and hats and whatever else, but it was called Cosmic Rainbow Photo T-shirts. And then I got a call from Procter & Gamble one day, and they said, "Well, if you can do this on one shirt, can you do it on 100,000? And of course I said, "Sure." I had no idea how to do it. I contacted another chemist friend of mine, and I said, "I hear that there's this new process in France that uses sublistatics, and it was sublimation, and it allows you to print big bolts of fabric." And I said, "You think we could get that ink and maybe transfer it on a printing press and print and then create shirts in volume using a similar sizing to what we created for the one-on-one?" And I said, "I don't think that's possible." Well, he ended up doing it, and we experimented for several months, and shortly thereafter, I took an order for 100,000 Mr. Clean t-shirts, which went off to Procter & Gamble. So it's the pure serendipity of this. You can see the connection between art and science and business. I didn't really begin this with the idea I was going to get in business. I got in it because I was interested in the art and in the science, but it migrated. So then we fast forward, and this really was the next transition I made. As you can see, the entangled string has stuck with me. Entanglement, I'm still Rocket Boy, even though I was 36 years old or something at the time. But the idea of being able to tie back in, the fact that I kind of dropped out and now I had an opportunity to come back in and really have fun doing what I wanted to do, but in a different context. So the next dozen or so years I spent in this realm. And as you can see, this, some of you who are old enough remember that there was a company called Cray Research, and they used to make big supercomputers. And you also remember that they were really good at making scientific visualizations. Happened, again, serendipity, that Cray Research started in my hometown. And the company that I worked for at the time in the investment business was going to take them public. And so I figured I could get an edge up on, I ended up going to Wall Street at a time when it wasn't a bad word. Became an analyst that basically covered supercomputing, scientific visualization, and graphics. And I came at a really good time because the bull market started about 6 months after I did. And I thought it was like shooting ducks in a barrel. This was easy. I did a spreadsheet and all the stocks went up. And, you know, it's great fun. Why didn't I do this before? It wasn't on the list of 100 things I was going to do in my life to do that. But I had the right combination of skills, I guess. So I followed this industry for, and still do, I guess, from its inception. And as a result of that, got to spend around my time around a lot of physicists. Because guess who bought the first supercomputer? Los Alamos. So I was in Sandia and Los Alamos and NASA. We used to call NASA Ames a petting zoo. Because as someone following computers, they had one of every single kind of computer you could ever imagine. So I could make one trip to NASA Ames and see everything. Another little known fact is that Seymour Cray used to design the Cray computer on a Mac. And at the same time, Apple was designing the Mac on a Cray. So now I'm going to jump to kind of fast forward again to a talk a little bit about the artwork and the things I'm doing now. I can get this to work right. I'll start with this one, and no sound on this, but you'll get the idea. So this was the last show I did, and it's kind of difficult to see these from, you know, with this resolution and light. But if you look very closely, you'll see that there are little strings, even in the darkest of dark, and I can show you it in a book if you're interested. And this whole show came about as a result of an interest in string theory. Just I was fascinated by things that are paradoxical and that I can't understand, and so I decided to undertake the task of reading the book and seeing if I could make any sense of it. At the same time, I was asked to chair to be on a panel with a well-known author and Buddhist monk, Matthew Ricard, who some of you might know. He has an extensive science background, very interesting individual, great photographer. Well, it turns out I spent about 3 days with him, and he happened to work at the Max Planck Institute in, I think, you know, microbiology before leaving as a intern with a Nobel laureate to go off to, I think he went to Nepal at that point in time, or Tibet, and became a Buddhist monk. Well, it turned out his father is it Jean-Paul Rivard? No, Rivel. Anyway, a famous philosopher. And so this guy had a very interesting cross-pollination. He was a scientist, grew up in a very aristocratic family, and yet had spent the last 20 years or whatever in a Buddhist monastery. So in my discussions with him, he was talking about the thought experiments that Buddhists take in approaching their understanding of cosmology. And thought experiments that come up in your book, I was thinking about, physicists use thought experiments. I remember reading that Einstein book. He uses thought experiments. So I thought, maybe a photographer could do a thought experiment. So these are thought experiments. And basically fusing the individual, the guru I showed you, I actually went on to go to Japan and at Kyoto University, and I studied Zen Buddhism there and spent a month with a Zen master. And when I got back, I kind of put those two practices together, and I've had a meditation practice for the last, many, many decades since I returned. But I tried to bring those disciplines to it, and all of these photographs in this show were taken with the same camera, the same lens, in the same environment. It was a macro lens. Most of them shot in my kitchen, and they were all taken of very ordinary objects. And the idea was to only to pick things that were influenced by the four forces, to the extent that I could understand them. And I, maybe if we have time, I will show you some of the original images. But I spent about 5 or 6 months, I think, trying to find the right algorithm to process these ordinary photographs, to make them look like what I envisioned strings to be vibrating at this low level. And I finally found one. And an astrophysicist friend of mine told me that what I found was something called the sum of squares algorithm that was used in his profession. And I played around with it. I love to have dials that I can adjust and change colors, which drives my scientist friends crazy because, of course, I'm taking their beautiful scientific visualizations and screwing with them. But that's what I like to do. This particular image I'll tell you a little bit about. One of the things I did is I went out and bought a kid's science project. Like we used to get chemistry sets, but you could go buy one and it had explained magnetism and chemical reactions. And so I took it apart, took all the metal filings out of it. I took a couple of magnets and used that to move around some of these particles. And that became the, you know, the basis for some of my visualizations. I can tell you most of them failed miserably, what I envisioned. But these actually were ones that came very close to what I had visualized. Once I understood how the algorithm worked, I could visualize how they would come out taking pictures of them. So this one, you know, I put titles on some of these that I, again, don't really understand, but I think I credited you. You know, spin minus two and sparticle. Actually, one of them is called the Higgs Ocean, and Brian Green had asked for a copy of my book when I asked him for permission to use it, which I sent to him, and so I've had a lot of fun with it. I'll show you another set here. Maybe while I'm on this theme, some of you may have seen that if there was a link on the site that David gave you, a little video that I had to prepare. I had found out from a friend of mine that the CERN had a artist in residence situation like this one, where it was kind of informal and you could come and go, and you know, there wasn't any official support for it, but they encouraged you to come and talk about it. So I went in September of last year with the idea that I might want to spend a couple months there doing the project I'm working on now, which is called Gray Matter, Dark Matter, and the Origins of Consciousness, Brain or Brain. Very appropriate that the conference is starting today. Well, anyway, I went there, and the day that I arrived, I was supposed to meet the woman in charge of cultural relations, and many of you, probably all of you, have been there, 10,000 scientists, and I don't think there are too many artists there. And this woman has responsibility for all culture that goes on at CERN. Well, I was supposed to meet her at 5 o'clock. The train, Swiss train, would arrive on time. I'd meet her at the train station. It turned out that we were on a French train. And we arrived a little bit late. Things got mixed up, and we didn't have a chance to meet. Well, I found out over the weekend that she had actually gone up to Linz, Austria, to announce a competition for this CERN artist in residence. I thought, oh, well, I've got a, you know, inside track here. I visited. I just did this Entangled Strings show. You know, the fact that I'm not an emerging artist might have some impact on it, but I thought I'd give it a try, even though as I mentioned the other night, I decided that I would never compete again. I didn't want to do that anymore in my life. Well, I didn't think there was going to be much competition. Again, I was wrong. In 6 weeks, they got 400 applications from 40 different countries, and there was a young actual physicist who was from Berlin, who was selected for the one slot that they had available. And it may have had something to do with a 10,000-year-old prize, all expenses paid, which was not the case for the project that I was looking at. But at any rate, I'm going to just run some of this little video because I think it will show you some of the kinds of things I'm looking for in this next project, which I've transplanted. By the way, once I made the connection with Kavli, and not only this institute, but also Neuroscience and Astrophysics Institutes around the world, I thought, what better place to do this project than here? So.
My entire life has really been focused on, you know, being on the boundary between art and science. I grew up in a family with a mother who was a lifelong artist. My father, on the other hand, was a crew-cut kind of guy, so having this kind of stoic Norwegian father and a mother who was quite the opposite was a delightful experience in retrospect. And I think it made it possible for me to pursue liberal arts and then be able to translate that into the world of business where I spent the best part of my career. I think what's most unique about this Louis-Mayer's Kaleidoscope program is that it does have these two components. It has the component of conceptualization, ideation, immersion with science, really trying to get close to what we call it a reciprocal interaction, to use the physics term as opposed to a collision. I'm more interested in kind of things that rub off on I'm there as opposed to going through the real fields of a collision. But if I carry that to the next step, obviously as an artist, I can't be conceptual. I'll kind of have to create something again in order to communicate with others what my dissertation is. My ideas relate to using the latest technologies in 3D visualization and sonification in environments that only exist a few places in the world, and I've been to several. So Ars clearly fits into that category. Ars Electronica is perhaps the most highly respected festival of its kind in the field of visual art. It's where it's happening in the same sense that CERN events domain has that same distinction. CERN is the epicenter of cosmological inquiry. It is where the latest and greatest technology and philosophy, to a certain extent, are meeting to take on some of the questions that have been pondered by man going back 100,000 years. What is the meaning of life and what is reality? These are very profound questions. The idea of trying to understand the nature of the universe and to do it in a collaborative environment that encourages the paradox, enigma, puzzle of reality and trying to figure out, you know, what is the true nature of things. So as I look at the Future Lab, I think about the Bio Lab, the Fab Lab, all of these facilities that are multidisciplinary, cross-disciplinary, and having the resources available to take my visualization and transfer it into something concrete. Because in the end, artists need evidence. The idea of having to track my creative process on the blog, the idea of working with mentors at both facilities, both CERN and ARS, and the Future Lab, is very intriguing to actually have that link. I've had experience in the past where that wasn't present, and I mean, it really challenging to be the lone, you know, person out there trying to get something to happen. So having a deadline where this has got to be done by the end of August is, for me, it kind of gets the creative juices going, and it's part of the artistic process. The prospect of actually being in CERN when this major inquiry is likely going to bring some kind of fruition, whether they find the Higgs boson or not, it's going to be a watershed event because it will impact the way that physics is looked at concept of physics will be turned on its head if, in fact, the boson is not discovered. So, you know, what could be more exciting than to be there, to watch firsthand this creative process when the aha moment happens?
Well, I couldn't have said it better.
Life has really been focused on, you know, being on the boundary between art and science.
There we go. Close that window. So I think that encapsulated why I'm here and the cooperation that I would love to have from all of you here who, in seeing some of those images, you might say, boy, there's something there that he might be interested in looking. I attended your lecture the other day. In fact, when I Googled myself to see if this is listed, your picture showed up on my Google. I don't know why that is, from entanglement, I guess, because I went to your lecture. But there were a number of images that I saw in her lecture that were fascinating to me, and I want to learn more about it. And I'm sure many of you have either sounds or algorithms or images that, you know, something that I could take a look at. This next project is going to be immersive. I spent 6 weeks last year across the street at the Allosphere, which is a 3D holodeck. If you haven't had a chance to go over there, if they have a demonstration while you're here, you ought to go. It's funded to the tune of maybe $12 million by the National Science Foundation. It has the latest and greatest 3D projectors that you go into a sphere that's 30 feet in diameter, 192 channels of sound, and surround you everywhere you look with high definition 3D and fed by supercomputers directly. So I know that there are some in this institute that have actually done visualizations over there. But I'm excited to go with immersive this time. So I'm trying to come up with sound, with 3D images and mashups. This happens to be a neuron growth. And it kind of reminded me of things I've seen astrophysicists photograph. And so I don't really care about scale and time. And so I'm not limited by equations. If I see something that's interesting, I basically just do it. I have an astrophysicist in Minneapolis who has this gigantic database that took about a year on a supercomputer to calculate, and he gave me a window into it, a VPN, so I can go roam around this, you know, billion point resolution database and find things that are intriguing and interesting to me and capture them. I think at this point I will stop, and maybe there are some questions. I'm happy to, if any of you are interested in some of the process, you know, stop by. I'm in 2327, and I'm happy to show you on a high resolution screen kind of how the work comes together. The prior show, by the way, that I did called Outer Spaces, for those of you who are more interested in that realm, that was a completely different project where I spent weeks, months assembling pieces that were stitched together and into artificial outer spaces. And I have that picture over there on the wall. It was a small part of one of my works. But I thank you for your attention, and if you have any questions, fire away.
Questions?
I just wonder if you're interested also in moving images. I mean, so sound is in time, and most of the other images you talked about, the images are still, generally. Or maybe the image was a still that moved, but are you interested in time developing images?
Yeah, in fact, exclusively this time around. I want to either create animations, if that's possible, or to find images that were created in 3D. And that's one of the advantages of working with supercomputer simulations, is that are done, you know, at very high resolution, is that I can literally take those data sets and manipulate them and come up with, you know, a very unique and interesting visual that could then be mashed up. So I might mash up a neuron with a
dwarf star that's exploding, because I like the way that those interact. I did spend some time, many of the images that you saw in that film were created by a researcher at the University of Minnesota who is one of the world's experts in neuron cone growth. And it was fascinating for me to learn, you know, how these things, you know, appear to grow. So absolutely, the more detail, the more resolution, the better. One thing interesting about CERN is that, you know, those detectors are cameras. They shoot 40 million pictures a second. And they only keep about 300 of them out of the 40 million that they shoot. I'm intrigued, you know, what's in the debris there? What did they throw away that might be interesting? And so those are the kinds of things I would love to have you bring forward. I go into a project really without any preconception about where it's going to go, because I discovered that, you know, I have a big idea, but if I'm collaborating, the ideas are stimulated by the people I'm around. So you're going to see me sitting in your lectures, and you're going to wonder, why would he be here? Follow the equations on the board. Well, I'm observing and listening, even though I don't fully grok what it is that that you're talking about. So I appreciate your willingness to let me come in and sit, even though I'm not contributing in that way. Other questions? Yes.
Yeah, you talked earlier during your hippie phase
about. I didn't use that word.
It looked like.
Yeah,
it was. About boy meets girl. So what happened to the girls?
She's going to be here tonight. I might ask her to come in and have some wine and cheese. When I met my wife, I was 5'2". Rocket boy, and she was 5'6", which is her current height. And to me, she tells me now, she said when she met me and kind of put the name Rocket Boy together with Gary Smeadie, she said, "That's Gary Smeadie?" So that's how we started our relationship. I dated her twin sister. I didn't know. But yes, Nancy and I have been married now for, since then. 42 years. So, thanks for asking.
Yes. So higher dimensions figure big in string theory. Have you thought at all about the challenge to somehow depict or aid the intuition of or visualize extra dimensions?
Yeah, I have. And it's been very complicated to visualize, even though I think in pictures that's sort of the way I think. There's one image in there, one of my favorites actually, called Multiverse, that I've tried to get what's going on in Scientific American, which is probably the publication that it's kind of my highest level of incompetence. I can actually read that and kind of understand it without going into the physics journals, but I think they do a great job of helping, you know, lay people. Or interested lay people understand what's going on there. But I'd love to talk to you or listen in on conversations you have about these extra dimensions. I just have trouble envisioning. There was a researcher at the University of Minnesota who I met at CERN who is interested in supersymmetry. This person is Yoshi, some of you may know him. But had some very interesting talks with him about supersymmetry, and there were things going on at the time, some announcements that, you know, supersymmetry was dead, and he's far from it. So I learned a little bit about that. Any other questions? Well, I'll wrap it up here for those that want to listen. I put together just a little bit of a string we can put on in the background for those. And I know a lot of you like music, so I put together a little clip here of Shooting Stars. These are all photographs I took.